Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. Welcome and thank you for being here. For those of you who are regular listeners, I know you may have noticed that we've been away for a while, so thank you for your patience. If you are new, welcome to the podcast, and please do check us out on theconversationpod.com, where you will find all the past episodes, and you will find, especially relevantly today, links to very interesting articles that we refer to in our conversation. This is the New York Update with my guest Jillian Steinhauer, who is the senior editor of Hyperallergic, a very cool New York-based art website that if you haven't seen, you should check out. I want to thank Rag Vartanian, the editor-in-chief of Hyperallergic, for putting me in touch with Jillian. Jillian was a wonderfully charming guest, I think you will find. So I think you're going to enjoy it. And we will get to that in a moment. I want to first tell you about our sponsor today. Our sponsor is Los Angeles Art Resource, which is a community information page founded in 2011 by artists Danielle McCullough and Eileen Schmeltz. Their mission is to empower Los Angeles area artists while providing a vehicle for collective success within the local arts community. They post regional job opportunities, calls for entry, grant deadlines, studio vacancies, workshops, participatory events and conferences, and provide links to a variety of LA arts venues, organizations, publications, and services. Currently, they are a wholly volunteer-based organization with fiscal sponsorship through Fractured Atlas. It's their goal to become an independently run nonprofit, bilingual English-Spanish source of web-based information for the Los Angeles arts community, and generate meaningful source of employment for artists. They accept donations through their website and are currently seeking to post free open calls for artist-run and nonprofit spaces in the region. Go check them out at losangelesartresource.com. All right, so today on the show with Jillian Steinhauer, we talk about Jay-Z's Picasso Baby, Marina Abramović's The Marina Abramović Institute, and her related Kickstarter project, the James Turrell shows in New York at the Guggenheim and in LA at LA County Museum. And finally, we talk about the Cooper Union protests, which Hyperallergic has covered closely over the last 6 months. So again, check out the website, theconversationpod.com. Please do like the show if you haven't already. Become a follower on Twitter, and donations are very much welcome. So let's get to that conversation now. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you soon. This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw, and I'm joined today by Jillian Steinhauer, who is the senior editor of Hyperallergic. Jillian, will you, just for listeners who are not familiar, will you tell us a little bit about Hyperallergic? I know you mentioned it's been around for like a couple years now.
Yeah, it's about 3.5 years old. We like to call it a blogazine. So it's an online art blog and magazine. And we basically, you know, we cover the art world, but we also cover broader ideas in visual culture. And we just try to be playful and serious and sort of create a conversation, actually, like the name of your podcast, around these issues, and try to make it more open than we find a lot of art media these days, like a lot of, you know, old school art magazines.
Right. And the comments section that you have, for example, to what extent is that part of that conversation, or is it like much more the whole spectrum of Twitter and Facebook and other social media?
We try to do all of those. I mean, We moderate our comments only just to make sure nothing's abusive, but otherwise we welcome all kinds of, you know, comments. And we get a lot, which is great. I mean, we get critical comments and encouraging ones, and people, if we make mistakes, people call us out. And they're often, on a lot of the bigger articles, there'll be, like, incredibly long comment threads that are super interesting to read, actually. And we encourage all the writers to respond to the commenters, so we get a dialogue going there.
Right.
But that also happens on Facebook a lot as well.
Okay. And have you done any public events, or do you plan to?
Yeah. We've done a couple of events. We had a big we threw a party for our third anniversary last fall. And we started doing this series of art talks We did the first one a couple months ago with Klaus Biesenbach.
Mm.
And we just, it was like a small sort of event at a bar, and we had him speak about Expo One and his project in the Rockaways. And we're actually doing the next one this coming Wednesday with A.A. Bronson and Carlos Mata, which should be great.
Was it
so,
hard?
Yeah, we're definitely doing events. And we've done events like with the Guggenheim Museum and up in the Bronx. And it's definitely becoming a bigger part of what we do.
Yeah, and it sounds like your presence is becoming quite known as well with that kind of activity.
Hopefully.
Was it challenging to get Klaus Biesenbach to hammer him down for a particular day?
I wasn't in charge of that. It was Frog. It was Frog, my editor-in-chief, who was doing that.
Yeah.
I suspect Klaus is very busy, but I think he was really gracious, and it was great to have him.
Cool. So starting with the Jay-Z Picasso Baby, now you covered this a little bit for Hyperallergic, right?
Yes, although I should say that I covered it from afar. I was not invited, so I didn't go.
Right, so that was a very exclusive ticket, was it not?
I thought it was very exclusive, and then many people I knew were there. I mean, not many, but I definitely knew people who were there, but I guess we didn't quite make the cut.
So were you working off of their comments, their stories about it, or did you have access to a video at a certain point?
Basically, I knew it was happening because my boyfriend, who's also an art writer, was invited, and he told me about it.
Okay.
And then the news sort of hit the blogosphere, and people started tweeting about it around that time. It was like the night before. And then that afternoon, Vines started appearing. And like my Twitter started sort of blowing up with people either tweeting about it or like linking to different videos and photographs. And then it just started blowing up. So it was easy to find information. And then everyone started covering it. So then there was also a lot of writing about it. Although I think we got ours out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Now, from the limited sort of perspective that I had on it, was mainly through Facebook. It seemed to be kind of this support of rapper culture, integrating into the art world. And then those that were like, I don't know, I honestly didn't read too much about it, but sort of the sense that I was getting is that other people were, this is kind of, I don't know if it's sacrilegious, the right word, maybe that's way too strong, but it's a stunt, I guess. I mean, it feels a little bit like a stunt, but why don't you kind of break down maybe what your perception was, and particularly in general, what kind of the angles were that were going on?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was a stunt. I mean, it was a music video shoot. Like, I think what happened was that it was originally framed to certain people. I'm not sure if this was Jay-Z's people doing or what, but it was framed as performance art. It was like, oh, he's going to be performing for 6 hours, and it was all reminiscent of Ronnie Carrington and Marina Abramović, and he said that he was inspired by Marina Abramović. So then everyone at first was like, seriously, this is performance art? But from what I've heard from people who were there, I mean, it was a music video shoot. He took breaks. He didn't perform for 6 hours straight. He like performed for, increments of like 20 minutes or like maybe even an hour, and then he would take a break and be gone for 15, 20 minutes and go like back to his room, and then he'd come back and do it all again.
So, well, that says it all right then, there.
Exactly. But then what's hilarious, because like, okay, so everyone gets all up in arms about it being performance art. We make a joke of it, which is basically what my post was. I mean, everyone read the headline, which had said like the day performance art died, but it was very tongue in cheek. I didn't mean
sure.
it. And if you read all the way through, you could tell. But then what I think is even more hilarious is that afterwards, when they released the video, they released it as a quote-unquote performance art film. And this is like a 4-minute long music video.
Now, isn't, you know what that's reminding me of? I can't you might be able to help me with this, but Beyoncé did a sort of self-produced film, and didn't it have a title that was sort of reminiscent of the title you just mentioned? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I know the film you're talking about.
Yeah, but,
I don't know, but
it had a similarly aggrandizing title, if I remember right. So anyway.
Yeah, and there's like a quote from Jay-Z in the voiceover in the trailer that's like comparing concerts to performance art, and he very much, they definitely framed it that way.
Yeah. And then you also covered, we should say, the Michael Mahalchik Picasso Baby, his own version of Picasso Baby performance at a gallery in the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
Did you go to that?
Yeah, I loved it.
So did he take breaks too, or did he stay up there the whole time?
I mean, he stood up there the whole time, but he was very relaxed about it. Like, he, you know, he was chatting with us, and there wasn't a huge audience when I was there, at least.
Yeah.
And if no one was there, I don't think he was performing if he had no audience. Like, I think it was very chill. It was not duration performance art. But he didn't, like, you know, he was there for the whole, like, 6 hours. Like, he wasn't, you know, taking large breaks or anything like that. And I have to say, like, when I went into that, I read about it and was like, oh, my God. Seriously, I was very skeptical, but I was like, well, it might be an interesting story. I'll just go. But I was pretty, I loved it. Like, I just thought it was pretty hilarious, given all the hype around the Jay-Z thing.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty clever.
Does Michael Michalczyk have a reputation as a performance artist? Did people know his work?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, he has a reputation as being, I think, of being very silly and, like, doing these sort of sometimes ridiculous things, but I don't think he's not known specifically as a performance artist.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It actually reminded me of something that happened way back when in undergrad, when a guy, a classmate, did this performance where he danced on the roof, and he had a video cast of it down by the elevators on the ground floor. And what was the song? It was Take Me Higher, you know, the... that song. And and then I actually, a classmate of ours who was having a hard time coming up with ideas, and I said, you know what you should do? You should just copy. I can't remember if I said you should copy that piece or you should just copy pieces. So like a day or two later, he was up there on the roof doing the performance again, basically his own version, but I think he used a different song. Anyway, that's what the Michael Michalczyk reminded me of.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, now that, you know, the music video has come out on HBO, is there really anything left from the fallout of this, or is it just basically a stunt?
Like, it's a stunt. I mean, I don't know. I've been trying really hard to think about it differently and see if I can sort of see other points of view. Like, I've been trying to read things that maybe are more embracing of it. And, you know, people, like, there were a ton, for instance, when we were talking about comments on Hyperallergic, I mean, there were tons of comments on these posts. And some people were saying, like, you know, Jay-Z is black and he's going into a traditionally white space and, like, you know, bringing hip hop into the art world and, like, making people respect him, which, like, I want to see that, but I mean, Jay-Z is so famous and he is such a celebrity, and almost everyone, I mean, and if you weren't press, like, you were a celebrity artist if you were in that room, or a celebrity creator or something. I just can't really see anything beyond,
yeah,
stunt, celebrity, feel-good sort of thing, which is why I like Michael Michalczyk's thing so much,
right?
Because it was so ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, actually. And just to sort of clarify about the crowd there, it was a number of art world celebrities, including, was Klaus Biesenbach one of them?
Oh, yeah.
Certainly, okay. Marina was there, right?
Although Klaus wrote a really interesting tweet that I don't have in front of me, but about how weird the whole thing was and how weird it made him feel. It was actually a really great assessment. And yes, Marina was there, and that was the video that sparked my post. There's a vine of the two of them, like, of her dancing while he's rapping at her, and it's sort of like watching a train wreck. Like, you can't look away. It's like so cringe inducing and weird, but kind of fascinating, and you're just like, oh my God, I have to watch this.
Right.
It loops because it's vine.
We will definitely get that link from you and post it. But there were just straight celebrities there as well, were there not?
Yeah. I mean, I heard that, like, Rosie Perez was there, and Adam Driver was there, like, actors and.
So wasn't Judd Apatow there as well? I thought I saw him on a still from with Jay-Z. So I don't know if that was the same.
That's
show.
That's totally possible.
Right.
I don't know for sure, but
right.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay, got it. By the way, Jay-Z was on Bill Maher the night that the Picasso Baby was premiering. And what was most interesting to me, I mean, he was a really good guest. He was fine. He said this really endearing thing where he acknowledged, you know, as he was being interviewed, he acknowledged the three panelists, you know, that were sitting right there saying, you know, I feel we're talking about this with these guys, you know, that I barely know sitting right here, something like that. And it, you know, it was very endearing and whatnot. But what I found interesting is, you know, they do the overtime portion, you know, that's only for the web. That's like another 10 minutes. And he was gone for that. Mm-hmm. So clearly he had better places to be once, you know, once the main section ended. I thought that was noteworthy. All right, let's move on from Picasso, baby. Maybe we should segue to Marina Abramović since, you know, there's that connection. So the Marina Abramović School, is it the Marina Abramović Institute, MAI, which is in Hudson, New York. This is a sort of a current thing if you're listening still in August, because today is the 18th of August. And as of today, she has $436,700 pledged towards $600,000 goal, and there are 6 days left. So I think it's been a long Kickstarter campaign, so it's going to be pretty much down to the wire, it looks like. What do you think?
You know, this is really great that you just brought this up, because right before we started talking, I tweeted about this.
Mm-hmm.
Being like, I hashtagged it Schadenfreude, and I said, like, wouldn't it be crazy if it didn't make it? But two people responded, and they pointed out, and I think that they're totally right, that she must have people on the back burner.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, donors or people. So there's no way she won't make it. I mean, she must have money lined up so that she'll make it, even if she just ekes by.
Well, and also, even if in theory, if the Kickstarter were not to succeed, I mean, there's presumably a fair amount of seed money that's already in play, I would imagine.
I would imagine, but that gets to the whole question, which I've been wondering, of like why she is doing a Kickstarter. People doing Kickstarters.
Right. It's a good point. And if you read the Kickstarter page, the sense is from their sort of spiel is that it is a way to, you know, introduce her and her project to a wider audience, as if that hasn't been done through HBO, you know, and the whole MoMA thing. You know, there's always more audience out there, I suppose. So, but what I wanted, what I wanted to sort of add though, regarding the Kickstarter, which is all quite amusing. First of all backers of this project received the $1 plus reward, the embrace, a hug from Marina Abramović. So, if you pledge $1, you get live event, the embrace, a hug from Marina Abramović, location to be determined, and the date. You know, there's always a date that's estimated for the, you know, delivery of a given item that one, you know, bids for or pledges for on Kickstarter. And so this one, I believe, is December 2014, you know, so plenty of lead time there. But what I find an interesting counterpoint to that is that at the $10,000 level, one of the two, I believe, $10,000 pledges is live event. Visit to an event of Marina's choice and lunch in New York City. Marina will choose an event to attend with you and four other backers, after which you'll all have lunch in New York City. But the other $10,000 reward is... You want to go ahead and read the other $10,000 event for us?
Sure. The exercises / live event. Nothing. Marina will do nothing. You will do nothing. You will not be publicly acknowledged.
Well done. So my question is, if you are going to take that $10,000 event, does that mean you are going to exclude yourself from the hug?
That's a great question. I have no idea.
Yeah. So, all right. So, Schadenfreude, Marina. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say that when you were talking about the hug, it made me think, like, I was looking over the Kickstarter page earlier today, and, like, part of what I think is so interesting about the Institute and Marina and all of this stuff is how, like, she started as a performance artist, but so much of it has become, like, spectacle, and I feel like I could almost see her taking all of those backers and, like, making them all show up at one thing and, like, turning the hug into some, like, massive performance piece that she calls it, where she gives everyone a hug. Like, I don't know, I just feel like everything has become such a spectacle, and the whole thing of the Institute is that you can always see everyone and everyone can see you, and it's like, I don't know, it's just, it's all very strange to me. It's very branded.
Yeah, okay, interesting. Would you say that from the time of the documentary about her and her work that was at MoMA, was that an important milestone time-wise? I mean, have things gone south from then, or were they already, I mean, as far as, let me put it another way, was she already getting deep into the branding, for lack of a better word, as that film was being made or released, or has it been more since then, do you think?
I don't even know. I mean, it's a good question. I would sort of think it's since the MoMA show. I mean, mm-hmm.
Did you happen to, you didn't happen to do the performance by any chance?
No, I mean, I saw it, but I didn't have the time or the energy to wait in line for hours.
Sure. What was your in-person take? Because I was not there. What was your in-person take on the sort of emotional resonance of what was going on?
I was rereading stuff this morning about this, and I definitely think I remember being really taken with the whole her actual performance where she was sitting in the atrium. I had never seen her live, and it was pretty fantastic to watch. It was very mesmerizing.
Yeah.
But then it was weird because you went upstairs where all the reperformers were reperforming works, and that was like a much different experience. I mean, it was kind of cool to see the works in action, but it felt very clinical
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting contrast.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. I feel like that show was a turning point that sort of turned her into something of a celebrity, and it's just been building and building. I mean, all the Institute stuff is just sort of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to, I don't know if this is annoying, but I do have to plug, we had one of our writers wrote a really great essay called "The Artist Isn't Present, But the Brand Sure Is," and it's sort of about this interacted with Marina's people and about the whole branding thing, and it's just... To me, it's gotten a little out of control. I mean, when you make a video with Lady Gaga doing the Abramovic method, I think you're a little far gone.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you bring this piece up, and we'll link to that so that people can get a backed up sense of what you're saying, about the whole branding situation. Yeah, very, very good. So there you go. Marina Abramovic, the Marina Abramovic Institute. Read more about it through theconversationpod.com. We will move on now to... Let's talk about the James Turrell Show, since we're talking about big museum institutional exhibitions. So the James Turrell Show, as we speak in mid-August, is still going on at the Guggenheim in New York and at LA County in Los Angeles. And I went to see the Turrell Show once I was able to procure a pass to the Perceptual Cell, which I will go into briefly in a second.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back just the other day because I was not able to fit in Breathing Light, which is a piece, speaking of waiting in line, that you have to wait in line about 45 minutes to an hour, which is nothing, I imagine, compared to the Marina Abramovic performance. But in any case, you know, it definitely was a substantial wait. So that's been my general experience with the James Turrell Show. What about yours?
Well, I have to say that I'm really spoiled, and I was able to go during the press preview.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really have to wait in line to get in. I do know my sister went recently and they got there, I think it was a Saturday, and they got there before the Guggenheim opened and they lined up, and she said it wasn't that bad. I mean, there was a line, but it moved pretty quickly. But I know it's been very popular, and I definitely have heard of some people having to wait. And I mean, as an example, so in New York, there's the main attraction, like the big sort of new piece that he made, but then there's a couple other pieces on view,
mm-hmm.
and one of them has a limit of how many people can go in. So even at the press preview, there was a line to get into that piece, just at the press preview.
Yeah.
Now I can't even imagine what the line is, and I know that people I know who've gone since haven't even waited in line for that piece.
Right. Well, let's talk about both of those pieces. The main piece, do you recall the name of the piece that fills the atrium?
Yeah, so the main piece is At and Rain, and I'm going to look up what the name of the other piece is.
Okay, so At and Rain is the piece that subtle shifts in color belight or lighten the spiraling hall or atrium, the spiraling atrium of the Guggenheim, and people sit in benches that are sort of angled up so you can more comfortably look up. I imagine there's quite a limitation on the number of people who could sit down and do that at a time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a huge space. I know that people have also been laying on the floor, although I haven't been, I did that, but I haven't been doing, I wasn't there, you know, during public hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's not a ton of space. There's definitely a limited seating area.
So for example, post the press preview, when a general visitor goes in, I wonder how, if they limit the number of people in at a time, you know, so that the
I
lobby,
think they must.
Yeah, the lobby doesn't get too clogged. So you don't have that problem with the LACMA show because it's quite spread out. A section of it is in the Resnick Pavilion, which is across the way. I was there on a Friday afternoon the first time, and you know, it wasn't too crowded. The Perceptual Cell, which is a piece that has been done in similar iterations, apparently at a few other institutions, you lie basically on this little sort of bench or platform, and you get pushed in to a sphere, a closed sphere, and you get your own personal light show, basically. And you can do either.
Wow,
this,
that sounds so cool.
Yeah. You can do two, you have choice of two programs, the soft program or the hard program. I chose the soft program because it seemed like it would be more meditative. I can't imagine how intense the hard program is, because it was actually pretty intense. There were periods, you know, where it slowed down, but then there were others where it just, you know, it was really fast and intense. And apparently the hard program is like that the whole time. And it's, I think, 10 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. So the big takeaway that I want to share with people who aren't going to be able to do it, because it's so completely packed. I mean, from morning to night, you know, I was actually able to get in thanks to sort of a press access kind of thing. Thank you, Jessica Unit, LACMA. So the big takeaway from it is, as opposed to being the analogy that I thought of before actually experiencing it, was going to be like a laserium kind of thing. But as opposed to that, where you're, you know, looking up at something and taking it in, this is as if you are being sort of supplanted with this visual information. It's as if it's coming into your eye sockets, you know, and into your brain. You know, it's that intense, because I guess you're that close to the ceiling, and the way it works on your eye is just so intense. It's just, you know, it's like being drilled into your eye sockets, in a sense. I don't mean to make it sound that violent, but in any case, it was really great. And I would like to go back and do the hard one, but I think logistically that's impossible. So I take it there wasn't a personal experience type of piece that was at the Guggenheim show, or is at the Guggenheim show.
No, I mean, it's definitely nothing that small scale. It's sort of the opposite. It's this massive thing. Although I have to say, I had a very personal experience when I was seeing it. But again, like, I don't know if that's because I was lucky enough to be there when it wasn't quite as crowded. I also stayed pretty much till the end of the press preview, and it thinned out a lot, and there were very few people left, and it was kind of nice.
Yeah. And so what
but
was
there
the...
is no personal thing.
Right. And what was the other piece that you were alluding to?
Oh, so the other, so there are a couple other pieces in the work, I mean, in the show, but it's very sparse. It's somewhat uneven, I think, but there are a couple of Aquitin prints that he did, and then there are a bunch, like maybe four other light pieces, and the one that I was talking about is called Iltar, and it's a space division construction, so it has like two rooms and very little light, and it's supposed to like affect your perception. It didn't really work for me, I have to say. I had to read about it afterwards to even understand, and I didn't really get it.
Yeah.
But there was a line just to get into that, because it's very, very low lighting, and so they can only let in a certain number of people at a time.
Right. Yeah, so the piece that I went back for, which I couldn't fit in the first go-round, is called Breathing Light. It's a new piece as well, and I think it's modeled pretty much after an earlier piece, but it's basically it's a big room that has a ledge at one end where there's actually a drop off, you know, that you're not supposed to go near the ledge, but it's lit sort of from below as well as from the sides. And it gives, you know, the room a certain effect, but the walls on the side are kind of curved up actually. That's to sort of make the space, you know, one sort of kind of binocular shaped, you know, oval space shaped space. And the idea is that you look either at the side walls or at the far wall, and you can't, especially if you cup your eyes with your hands, you have no depth perception. You know, that's sort of one of the ideas of it. And there are subtle shifts in color, you know, which are nice. But the problem is, and I think this is going to apply to the Guggenheim show as well in a lot of ways, is that, you know, you wait in line for quite a while. For me, it was about 45 minutes to an hour, and seven people at a time go into this room. Now, it seems that the optimal number of people in that room would be 1 to 3, so that you don't have people in your periphery and so on and so forth. So this raises the larger question of how is great work that is sort of ideally experienced with a small number of people, compromised by being a huge popular art event.
Right.
You know, that's and great. And that's, it's just an incredible, paradox that, you know, this is like one of the biggest contemporary blockbuster exhibitions that I can think of in years. And that's a, you know, in theory, that's a great thing. You know, it exposes so many people who otherwise would not be exposed to great contemporary art. But at the same time, everybody's experience is compromised.
Right. And I also, you know, I do think also it's a little strange, like, it's sort of weird because I think having to wait in line and all the build-up at this point creates these weird sort of expectations that I think also affect your experience. I went into the Guggenheim show, and the main piece, At and Rain, did like have a really wonderful effect on me, and I loved it. But this other piece, Iltar, which I should say is early, it's from 1976, I waited in line for it. I didn't really know what I was getting into, and it disappointed me. But I wonder if part of it is like waiting in line and expecting that you're going to have this like transformative experience. Like, I almost wonder if that sort of ruins the experience a lot of times. Like, things and often become letdowns because
yep.
it's like there's huge buildup and you have to wait and wait, and you're like, I'm going to have this revelatory experience. And then you sort of, you know, you inevitably don't in some cases.
Yep.
I don't know. I think it's tricky there too.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that whether you're somebody covering it, you know, whether you're an artist and you feel like you're obligated, or whether you're just, you know, a sort of very infrequent art goer that, you know, is not a big art person, you're there and you see this line, you feel like, you know, I'm here, I might as well see this. And then you wait and you wait, and your expectations are like, this better be good. You know, whether you're saying that consciously or just completely unconsciously. So that
right.
letdown. Yeah. And I think with the Breathing Light piece that I described, there was a certain element of that. You know, like, I set aside time just to go back to that show so I could see this piece that I missed, you know, and that's building up the expectations. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I mean, the piece of the Guggenheim, the main one, what you were saying before about the sort of clash of the personal or the sort of more private experience versus the big one, it's interesting because I think in the case of Guggenheim, he really built that piece. I mean, I think it's probably better when it's less crowded, but it is a really big sort of all-encompassing thing that a lot of people can see at once.
Right.
It seems like that was somewhat, at least in his mind, like, because it was built for the space, especially, like, it's a site-specific new work. So I think there is an element of accommodating that.
Yeah.
To a certain extent,
yeah.
At least at the show here.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I don't think LACMA has a piece like that. And it
right.
looked like from
but
the
people here have been really critical of it. So
right. Yeah. Well, what I was going to ask actually is, and maybe this, you know, feeds into the critical thing, is that based on watching just a little bit of the video, you know, on the Guggenheim site about the piece, lots of logistics, engineering, and probably enormous expense went into installing that. I mean, to what extent is that some of the feeding into some of the criticism of the show?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I was trying to read a mix of things. I actually meant to reread Roberta Smith's take, but a lot of pieces I've read have been almost not non-committal, but I found Roberta Smith's take in The Times and some others to be like critical without being really takedowns. They were just sort of like, well, this was probably really expensive. I did read one piece by Blake Opnik that was very critical, that was like, this is so expensive, and is this really the best way to spend the money? So there definitely has been criticism of that.
Yeah.
I personally don't totally buy that as a critique
sure.
of this work. But
Yeah. You know, it's just something that when you watch the video and you see these people installing these gigantic discs, you know, and you know, multiple laptops. I mean, you know, maybe I'm being completely naive in even talking about this, but it's certainly something that comes into your periphery that, you know, there's a lot involved, but
there's tons involved.
I think the reason that I think that, and I think it's okay to think that, is that when you think of, obviously, the Roden Grader is maybe not the best example to compare to, which obviously is a lot of investment and expense and time. But thinking about like the theater, home theater pieces and the more public theater pieces where, you know, it's a cutout hole or square in the ceiling, you know, in comparison to the thing that was done at the Guggenheim, it seems a lot more sort of low key and kind of modest, but I think it's all relative because those are only experienced by a small number of people, whereas this Guggenheim piece is much more, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's sort of, I don't know, this is why it's tricky for me. Like, I get that maybe it was insanely expensive and maybe some of that money should have gone somewhere else. And I'm also, I mean, I feel very critical often about art that really pins itself on experience or is really, really big, which I feel like we get a lot of these days. But I don't know, part of me feels like isn't the point like that we can, at some point, if we respect and, you know, an artist's work enough, we can enable them to do something they wouldn't have the chance to do otherwise. I mean, this is a really incredibly unique thing. I mean, he transforms this incredible space. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. So part of me feels like, I don't know, why shouldn't we spend the money on that? That's pretty amazing. I mean, they're not just spending tons of money to mount a survey. They're actually creating a whole new work.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're reminding me of sort of one of my general takeaways, which gets very watered down very quickly. But nonetheless, when you're seeing the show and you're seeing individual pieces at the James Turrell show, the thing that occurs is this is work that is extremely experiential and makes you think about what you're experiencing and the time you're experiencing it as much as any other work ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think, inevitably, I think it's very difficult to put that into a museum.
Right.
I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think there are always going to be issues because it's not work that's really made for a museum. And at the end of the day, like, do I maybe still prefer Meeting, which is his, like, maybe his first, one of his first Skyspaces, which is in Queens at PS1? Possibly, because that work, like, is amazing. But I also think if you're going to put Turrell in a museum, it sort of, to me, makes sense what they did with the Guggenheim, where it was like this crazy big thing.
Yeah.
Because you, in some ways, you don't get overloaded by trying to see like 20 James Turrell pieces, which just seems insane anyway.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, James Turrell still up, I believe, through into October. Is that right? Both spaces, if I remember.
Maybe it might be September here. It's September 25th. So
okay, so late September. And if you're in LA and you can somehow finagle, you know, induce, steal a spot in the perceptual cell for 10 minutes, I couldn't endorse it more. But, you know, I think that's a possible task. But good luck. All right, so let's move on to the Cooper Union. Now, the Free Cooper Union student protests, which you at Hyperallergic have been covering pretty much the whole scope of it. I'll sort of set this up briefly. Basically, in, what was it, December, it was announced, December of 2012, it was announced that Cooper Union would no longer be free for undergraduates. The students protested. They encamped in the school in the clock tower, and then subsequently, more recently, they encamped in the president's office. And there has been some headway, but it really remains to be seen how much. So why don't I let you now do sort of your version? I mean, this has been going on, we should just say, from December through at least mid-July, correct?
Yeah, so it hasn't gone on since December. They first occupied in December because they were protesting the potential of charging tuition because it was becoming more and more apparent that they were probably going to charge tuition, but it wasn't officially announced until April that they would be charging tuition.
Right, right. Okay. So now in July, mid-July, what I think was the sort of last event was that when they had the sit down at a alumni's house in Cooper Square who happened to be, who lived just down the street?
Yeah, I think so. When they ended. I mean, I was looking back over this, and they occupied the president's office for 65 days, which is a really long time.
Yeah, wow. I didn't realize it was 65 days. The thing that made me realize or sort of made me more cognizant of this being sort of transcending, you know, just being a protest, was the fact that they did artify it, and you know, in a good way, not necessarily in a bad way. They had black banners that were flowing out of the windows of the president's office, correct? So that were supposedly, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. signifying the takeover by unfurling them from the second-floor windows of a foundation building. So
yeah, and there's been lots of art stuff. I mean, there was when the school year ended, there was the end of the year show, and the students who were occupying mounted like their own show that was sort of the alterna show of their work. And in the first occupation, they also created work while they were up there that we wrote about. So they've been very creative about it.
Yeah, I think we should contextualize this situation, because one of my instincts about the whole Cooper Union and covering it is, you know, if you're not in school, if you're an artist, and or if you're somebody who follows what's going on in the contemporary art world, quote unquote, how much is this on your radar and how much do you care? You know, this is kind of about the plight. Obviously, it has much bigger implications and, you know, reverberates out in a certain way. And there haven't been these issues going on at other art schools, but it is art school. So in that sense, I mean, I guess what I'm suggesting is, aren't there a lot of people who maybe don't care that much about what's going on at Cooper Union? Or would you argue against that presumption?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, when I was talking about this with my boyfriend, he sort of, because he knows that you guys are based in LA, he was like, you should tell them that it's sort of the Cal Arts of New York. which is to say that, like, and, you know, I have to admit, like, I didn't really think a lot about Cooper Union before all this started happening. But if you look at the list of alumni from Cooper Union, it's, like, pretty insane how many impressive, smart, creative people have gone there.
Right.
And so I think it really does matter. I mean, if you care about the art world and you care about art, I mean, Cooper Union, so it has three schools, art, architecture, and engineering. I know a lot less about engineering. But I know, you know, especially for art students, I mean, art is not necessarily the most lucrative career. And the fact that these people get to have a free education at a really excellent school with really involved faculty who feel really strongly about the community that's created there, and then hopefully a lot of them go on to be major artists, I feel like if you care about the art world, it matters. Because, you know, there are always these certain schools that are bastions of creativity and that are really special places. And from everyone I've spoken to at Cooper Union, either faculty or student, this is one of those places. So I think, and like on a certain level, it seems like a local story, but I do think it matters.
No, I wasn't concerned that it was only a local story. I was concerned that it's just a school story, you know, and not
right.
really a large
art. But don't you think, like, education? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like, to me, education is a huge issue that is sort of bearing down on this country, like higher
right.
education, especially. And I think this ties into it, too. I mean, how many schools are there that are affordable, let alone free?
Yeah.
Like, very, very, very few. So I think it also ties into those larger questions, which I think are totally, you know, at the forefront of anyone's mind if they're having a child. I mean, how
right.
are people going to afford higher education, right? I mean, it's becoming
yeah.
less and less feasible.
Well, how many students approximately are in each Cooper Union class? Do you have a sense of that number?
I actually don't know.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to assume, you know,
I know it's a very small.
Exactly.
Very limited.
Exactly. That was basically where I was going. It's a very small number of people. So it's a very exclusive place to get into and to be. And it's an incredible opportunity going, you know, having a very high-end art education for free, basically. I guess, where am I going with this? I think, it's important, but because it's such a unique situation, it's only in a way it's only affecting the lucky few who get to have that experience. So for everybody else, including the people who go to Cal Arts and pay what I don't know what it is, $25,000 a year these days, you know, they're like, well, you know, speaking of Schadenfreude, you know, so you know, I think also, another sort of very cynical reaction that I honestly, that kind of bubbles up, tell me what you think, is that what we've been conscious of in the last 5 to 10 years, maybe 15 years even, but certainly the last 10, is that there are a ridiculous number of art students, you know, that are coming through and entering out into the market, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to say, fuck the Cooper Union students, we need less artists anyway, you know. I mean, that's absolutely absurd, but I don't know, maybe it's a good thing. Maybe I'm realizing that it's actually a good thing because it gives students an opportunity who wouldn't otherwise have it to get into the art world. But I mean, is that enough to make a difference?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I definitely see what you're saying, and I've had all these thoughts in my head, but I guess I have sort of two thoughts. chain reaction. One is about what you just said. I mean, I think that this is true for not just the art world, but it's true for the art world and the wider world, that a lot of spheres are, you know, pretty hegemonic. I mean, the art world is definitely somewhat diverse, but obviously, like, if people need to get MFAs to get noticed, they have to be able to pay for an MFA, and so it becomes a money thing, which is how sort of education works in general. So I think to have a school where you don't have to pay opens doors to a lot of people that maybe couldn't afford to go to college otherwise, or such a good college or art school. And I think the art world needs more diversity. So if it's opening the doors for people who money would be an issue and there would be a class issue anyway, then I think it's really important, because the art world definitely needs more diversity. I think that's incredibly important. And second of all, I have to say, I mean, I was reading, if you want more reading on this, Felix Salmon at Writers has done a lot of really great writing about it.
We'll link to it. We'll link to his piece, yeah.
Yeah. So he pointed out, and I think this is great too, is like when you look at the language used by the president and the board of trustees, there's a lot of talk of it becoming like more of a global brand and establishing the brand and having a wider reach and et cetera, et cetera. And the thing is, I guess the question is, if you want to think of how education should work in this country versus how it's working now, the question is, do we really need another really big mega school that has a really big global brand? I mean, is that really useful? I mean, yeah, maybe it's like, oh, well, it's only a lucky few who don't have to pay. But it's also like, I don't know, like, why does New York need another massive university that's, you know, trying to build this global brand and extend its reach and stuff like that? Why not stick to something that's been working really well, that's this really intimate, small environment that opens its doors and doesn't have that global reach but has a really, really amazing reputation here? You know, I don't know, I just feel like not one size fits all in terms of schools.
I mean,
in some ways, it's a moot conversation, because it seems like they're going to start charging tuition. There's nothing we can do, sort of, like, to be very cynical.
Yeah.
But I do think it's sad. It makes me sad.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think what you're saying, but I wonder if the students, for the most part, who get in are students who are not of means, or if it's much more of a crapshoot, if you have kind of a balance of both.
Right.
You
good
know.
Question.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's data on that anywhere.
Okay. Well, here's another slightly unrelated question, which is, do you have a sense, maybe you didn't cover this story that closely, but do you have a sense of the students who were particularly active in the protesting, maybe most of them were, but the ones that certainly got the most coverage, whether maybe they're, I had a sense that this was going to transform their lives and their careers, you know, that it was going to affect the work that they made and would, you know, possibly fling them towards a pretty activist-heavy life or career.
Maybe. That's definitely possible.
Yeah.
I spoke to some of them, but I don't really, like, I know them that well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're, I mean, it does seem like a very activist. I mean, they've been very organized, and they've had all the language of a very sort of activist-y, Occupy-type group.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's hard to tell, right? I mean, it could affect them forever, or they could move on and, you know, grow older and it could sort of fade. I feel like I don't really know.
Yeah, sure. Well, we will link to a few of the key coverage of the Cooper Union protests and sit-ins and what have you.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I just have one other thing that I think we should briefly talk about, and that is,
we're
mid-August now, and you basically said before that things have been really quiet lately. How palpable is it in mid-August that the art world, you know, is out of town, is shut down and whatnot? I mean, most of the in LA, there are actually some galleries that have shows that are kind of continuing, but several of them, you know, sort of ended maybe early month and they're going to open, or early to mid-month, and they're going to open again in like September 8th or something like that. Is it similar in New York?
Yeah, I mean, it feels, well, you know, but it depends on which art world you're talking about. The galleries, yes. I mean, they all go into summer hours, which means they're not open on the weekends, a lot of them. Like, most of Chelsea is closed.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know that last year, and I went on like a Saturday in August last year, and I was so angry because everything was closed.
Sure.
And I was so mad. I was very indignant. I was like, oh, they're in the Hamptons. I can't even see their shows.
Yeah.
So I feel like the galleries are very dormant right now. I have to say there are a ton of fantastic museum shows up right now, and mm-hmm. I'm scrambling to get to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it depends where, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of like outdoor movies and like film happening at a lot of different museums. But the galleries are very quiet.
Right. And what percentage of your sort of coverage or your writing would you say that encompasses generally?
You know, it's interesting. So in terms of the actual writing and coverage, galleries are not that much a part of it. I mean, we run a fair amount of gallery reviews on the site, but they usually come in from freelancers.
Mm-hmm.
I'll write about stuff if I see something that really strikes me. I mean, I definitely do cover galleries. But I feel like it's more... it just informs me more overall. Like, I don't write about everything I see, but I try to go see a ton.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time just catching up and going to neighborhoods and going to galleries. And so I think it's the, maybe you see the effect less in translation to my writing, but I feel like I haven't really done a good gallery day in a while. Although actually I went to Chelsea a couple weeks ago on a weekday and managed to see some good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I shouldn't say that's totally true, but it does feel very quiet and
you've kind of led me to something that I was thinking about before we got on, which is that it seems as though one of Hyperallergic's missions, whether overtly or covertly, is to cover sort of the more web or savvy or sort of alternative art world type things rather than just covering the mainstream gallery world.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we like to do everything, and if it's interesting or worth discussing, we'll do it. You know, we'll talk about it. But yeah, I mean, I think that there are so many magazines or websites and that just have sections or basically are devoted to just writing gallery reviews, which is great, but that's just not what we are. I mean, I think we want to open people up to, you know, things they've never heard of, or maybe a small gallery in Bushwick that they've never been to, or a nonprofit or alternative thing. Yeah, there's definitely a push to try to cover the stuff that doesn't get covered as much in the mainstream.
Well, Jillian, I hope you come back. We'll make it shorter,
I
promise.
Yeah, this is great.
Excellent. Thank you so much for talking to me.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Excellent.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you again very much for being here. Do check us out on theconversationpod.com. Give us some communique of any sort, and we will talk to you soon. Thanks so much again. Ciao.